You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Babbel, the app that can help you learn a new language step by step, building your confidence from day one by giving you the skills and phrases that mean you can make real progress with just 10 or 15 minutes of learning a day. As we prepare for the new professional cycling season, perhaps you're planning a trip to see one of the Grand Tours and you'd like to learn enough Italian, French or Spanish to help you get the most out of your adventure. However you learn best, Babbel will adapt to your strengths and you can tailor your lessons to focus on listening, speaking, reading or writing. As well as the lessons which build your knowledge and confidence, there are podcasts so you can really immerse yourself in your new language. Right from the start, you'll learn practical words and phrases that you can use in real life situations because the lessons are devised by real language experts. You can start speaking with great confidence in as little as 3 weeks. Stick at it and you could become as fluent as Daniel. There's a special limited time deal for all of our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/cycle. That's 60% off at babbel.com/cycle. And it's spelled babbel.com/cycle. Rules and restrictions may apply. Get Grand Tour ready with Babbel. Now, let's get the 2026 season underway.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on January the 14th, 2026, a year in which Nostradamus predicted that the great swarm of bees will arise, outing himself as a Visma Lisa Bike Ultra, or someone who wasn't abreast of Simon Yates' retirement plans. Incidentally, neither were Yates' bosses, but more on that later. My name is Daniel Freeman. I'm the host of this first episode of the new year, in which the first episode of the Cycling Podcast, I should tell you what the show is actually called, of the new year, in which we will also turn soothsayers and tell you what else will occur in professional cycling over the next 12 months. Joining me to do that today is the Nostradamus of Not Watford, Mr. Lionel Burney. Lionel, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Daniel. Happy New Year to all of our listeners. The, much anticipated speculation episode. Not my forte, this. I think if last year's predictions were anything to go by, our crystal ball's got a crack in it, hasn't it?
And there were some good ones. We'll maybe recap some of the predictions from last year, indeed, later in the episode. Lionel, incidentally, I said we will turn soothsayers in this episode. I was intrigued about the what is a sooth? What is sooth? Can you say sooth? Anyway, I did a bit of a deep dive on this. Do you know what sooth is? It's the truth or justice in Old English, apparently. So you can say sooth by predicting the future. Apparently. So every day is a school day, including in 2026.
Fascinating stuff. Very interesting. Yeah. Great.
Yeah, really. Really
fascinating. Bowled me over there.
Well, there you go. Lionel, this is the time of year when thoughts do turn to what is about to occur in the world of professional cycling. Of course, we've got the Tour Down Under happening over the next few days. But... a lot of teams are still at training camps. Most teams have a training camp going on at the moment. And the first thing we're going to deal with today, or the first bit of speculation we're going to indulge in, or the first cue for speculation, happened yesterday. That was Visma Lisa Bike's media day down on the Costa Blanca in Spain, in Benidorm of all places. I know you're very fond of Benidorm, aren't you? And there was some big news that we kind of anticipated. And wasn't it? It was Jonas Vingegaard announcing his race program for 2026. And the revelation, the shock revelation, that he's going to be riding the Giro d'Italia for the first time in 2026. Now, this is going to be the subject for some of our speculation, predictions, for some of our friends. We've asked friends of the Cycling Podcast, contributors of the Cycling Podcast, for their predictions for 2026. We're going to hear lots of those in due course. But Lionel, what was your initial reaction to this news from Ving the Merciless? First prediction, that nickname is not going to
That's not going to catch on.
2020. It's not going to catch on in 2026 either. Just like it didn't. I tried, but it hasn't in 2025, 2024, 2023, and so on. Anyway, Lionel.
Well, we may hear from Brian Nygaard a bit later on, but he got a little bit of grief for suggesting that this would be the smart play for Jonas Vingegaard and Visma Lisa Bike to try and get themselves out of the way of Tadej Pogacar and complete the Grand Tour triple crown of winning the Tour de France, of Vuelta a España and the Giro d'Italia. And I think it's a smart idea. Tadej Pogacar rode and won the Giro, of course, backed it up by winning the Tour de France. I think this will be the real test of Vingegaard and Visma Lisebike's mettle, whether he can double up in the same way. I have my doubts, but that is what the narrative of the whole season is going to be about, isn't it? I can't wait. It will soon be time for the In Flanders Fields from Middelkerke to Wevelgem Classic, or the Ronde van Brugge. All the races to look forward to in the spring before we even get to the Giro d'Italia. So, are you unaware of these name changes?
Okay. That sounded obtuse or slightly facetious.
No, not at all. Not at all. I must admit, I'm not sure about the rebranding of the Gent-Wevelgem to In Flanders Fields from Middelkerke to Wevelgem. It doesn't trip off the tongue, does it?
Well, on that note, Lionel, I mentioned Nostradamus earlier in 2016 predicting a swarm of bees. So good year for Jonas Vingegaard in 2020, possibly, according to Nostradamus. Well, his predictions actually, I mean, his big book of predictions, I think that's what it was called in 15, whatever he wrote it.
Is it online?
I think you can buy it on Amazon. He didn't specifically talk about 2026, but he did talk about the number 26, and that was the association with the swarm of bees. However, in that vein, I wrote down 26 predictions this year. I'm not going to give them all. Rest assured. However,
why don't we put your 26 predictions in the 1101 cappuccino? And
okay,
we'll do that.
Okay.
How about that?
We'll do that. But I can tell you that coming in at number 15, talking of name changes of races, coming in at number 15 was us continuing throughout 2026. And by us, I mean everyone continuing to call what was formerly the Critérium du Dauphiné, and not its new name, the Tour, Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. I got an email about that in my inbox this morning about the presentation being imminent, and there's always, whenever I see that name, at this point there is a moment's confusion, shall I say, because of course we do all know it as the Dauphiné.
Indeed.
Anyway, Lionel.
Yes.
On Visma Lisa Bike, I think we'll probably talk even more about this later in the episode, but the one big question mark I have, and a lot of other people have as well, is the Vingegaard plan in the context of what's just happened with Simon Yates. Because as we know, we are going to talk about it later, Simon Yates just announced his retirement. And a lot of people thought with the recruitment that they have done, or have not done, that team, they were already maybe a little bit short in terms of climbing support. And I would sort of suggest that if Vingegaard is going to do the Giro and the Tour, and I was speaking to one of our colleagues from TV2 Denmark last night, Søren, and he said that the clear message he got from Benidorm yesterday was that the Tour is still priority number one. But I feel as though there is no margin for error now in terms of team support for Vingegaard, in terms of experienced team support in the mountains, particularly, obviously, they've got Sepkus, they've got Jorgensen, who's going to do the Tour de France. They've got other guys like, you know, Bart Lemon. Ben Chula is going to be really important. They've signed other mountain domestiques, Piganzali, and they've got Nordhagen, who's moving up, the young Norwegian as well. But there's not a lot of wriggle room there. If someone has an injury, someone has a crash, someone has illness, then I think they're going to be very exposed indeed. The message that was coming yesterday from Visma was that they feel they're very well covered on the flat, and that support on the flat is going to be more important than support in the mountains. And if Vingegaard has to fend for himself, then he's more than capable of doing that.
The comparisons with Pogacar in 2024 will come thick and fast as we approach the Giro through the spring. The biggest thing for me at this point is that Jonas Vingegaard will go up against Joao Almeida by the looks of things, won't he? And that's significantly stiffer competition than anything that Pogacar faced a couple of years ago, I would suggest. So it's not a case of Vingegaard just, you know, pinning on a number and riding around Italy and collecting the pink jersey at the end. So it does set up quite a mouthwatering Grand Tour trilogy this year. We'll see how it all pans out, of course. Back to the bees?
Back to the bees. Well, should we have our first round of predictions from friends? First three voices you're going to hear in terms of soothsayers. That's going to be Rob Hatch, who's in Australia. He's been commentating on cricket, but he will soon be turning his attention to cycling. We're going to hear from him. We're going to hear from Graham Wilgos, who, of course, has been with us on Tour de France the last couple of years. And we're going to hear from the host of the cycling podcast, Femina, Rose Manley.
Hello, everybody. Rob Hatch here. Hope you've all wintered well and are ready for some bike racing. I'm off to Adelaide in a few days. I'm in Perth. I've seen the Aussie National Championships already, and I'm going to be at the Tour Down Under in a few days' time. So looking forward to that. For this season, I predict that Matthew Brennan will be the breakout star of the spring. I think he's going to win a big one-day race in Belgium. Pogacar will tick off one of his two missing monuments. Vingegaard will beat Pogacar to win all three Grand Tours by taking the Giro d'Italia title. And between all of us, Dick Athlon will set the unofficial record for the number of different pronunciations of its team name with all those letters that come after it.
Hello, chaps. Happy New Year. Graham Wilgos here. Let's say that Isaac Del Toro will finish second on the podium behind Tadej Pogacar at the Tour de France, giving UAE Team Emirates a first and second place finish this summer. Of course, it will be the first time since 2020 that we haven't had a Tadej Pogacar, Jonas Vingegaard, 1-2, sharing the top two steps. And it will be the first time since 2019 that a team will have done it at the Tour with a 1-2. That team was, of course, Ineos with Egan Bernal and Geraint Thomas. One more prediction for you on that note. Ineos riders will give up wearing their grotesque off-white, petroleum grey, whatever we're calling them, shorts by the end of January and switch to black ones instead.
Well, hello, guys, and Happy New Year, listeners. It's Rose Manley here from the cycling podcast Feminan. My prediction for the women's peloton is that someone is going to do the Giro double this year. They're further apart than they were last year. So we've got a huge chance for someone just to make it their year. And I think that person is going to be Demi Vollering. I mean, that may sound like not a very bold prediction. She is always, of course, one of the favourites for every single race that she's in. But yeah, she's never won the Tour before. So what a great way to win that, wouldn't it be, if she did the Giro Tour double? That would really make it a standout year. She's going to have really hard competition, of course. We've seen the emergence of some brand new GC stars that we weren't expecting. Marlon Reusser last year, Sarah Gigante, who just needs to get those descending skills up to scratch, and then she'll be an absolute weapon. And of course, we've got the return of Lotta Kopecky after a terrible year last year. Pauline Ferrand-Prévot. Oh, I'm talking myself out of my own prediction here, guys, aren't I? But yes, I'm going to say the Giro Tour double for Demi Vollering. Of course, you can follow along with all that happens in women's racing this year by listening to the Cycling Podcast Feminan with me and Denny Gray and Rebecca Charlton.
Well, Lionel, I think this is the order in which we heard them. Rob Hatch predicting Matthew Brennan breakthrough. Incidentally, Lionel, if I consult my list of 26 predictions, number 18 is that Matthew Brennan will win Paris-Roubaix. That is based on how adeptly he rode his first Paris-Roubaix last year. He was called in at the last minute, if I'm not mistaken, last year, at the very last minute, and he was absolutely superb until the last sort of 50 kilometres. So that's one of Rob's predictions and one of mine. Pogacar, I think Pogacar's going to win one of his the remaining San Remo Liège. Thoughts on not Liège, San Remo Roubaix. Lionel, thoughts?
Well, I mean, predicting a breakthrough season for Matt Brennan is a bit like saying that Sunday follows Saturday, I think, at this point, based on his debut season in the World Tour. A huge talent, a versatile talent as well. There's an awful lot of races that fall within his capabilities. Paris-Roubaix probably is one of them. I wouldn't necessarily go as far as to say he would win it this time out, but he'll certainly be in the mix, you would think. And, well, the challenges for Pogacar to complete that set of all five monuments remain the same as last year. Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix rely on a sort of an almost imperceptible je ne sais quoi, whatever the Italian for je ne sais quoi is. What is that, Daniel? It can slip away. Both races could slip away. It's not necessarily about being the best rider in the world. There's an awful lot more factors that will come into play, but that's what's going to keep us watching through April, isn't it? And his determination to go back to Paris-Roubaix, probably with his team bosses at UAE, Team Emirates, kind of wincing a little at the prospect of anything going wrong, you know, watching through their fingers. You know, that's something to really look forward to in the April.
But we are firmly in the realms of speculation, the kind of speculation that you particularly hate here.
We'll see, won't we? Why don't we just wait until the results are published by Nostradamus?
Yeah.
In his big book.
Yeah.
Graham Wilgos mentions a 1-2 for UAE at the Tour. I mean, that, again, looking back at last year, I can see the logic there. UAE Team Emirates, you know, slightly weakened in a sense, losing João Almeida, but, you know, Isaac Del Toro's emergence and sort of, you know, catapulted himself up the pecking order at UAE Team Emirates, and you could certainly see them doing a 1-2. Graham there making a point about Ineos and their grey shorts. I mean, you're our sartorial
I don't care about this stuff. I really don't care about this stuff. The one thing I would say is that should Ineos pivot to black shorts? Currently, I actually quite like the shorts, the grey shorts. I think whether they do or don't pivot might depend on how bad the weather is at races this February and March, because those shorts could become slightly revealing, shall we say.
They're perfect. They're a perfect colour. They look like they've got dirty and not been washed adequately. It's a kind of a grubby grey, isn't it?
But unfortunately, I think they might become quite transparent. But should they make that pivot line, or the kit would bear an uncanny resemblance to, do you remember the EF kit of 3 or 4 years ago? It's probably more than that now. I did look this up a couple of weeks ago, but they had an orange and white kit at one point. I think it was when it was still EF Drapac, and I think it was only for one race. It may have been for the Giro d'Italia, because they often do a different kit because of the clash with their pink, but it would be almost identical with an orange band at the top, white, and then black. Anyway, Lionel, as promised, well, I did promise that we're going to be talking about Simon Yates, other things. Who else might finish on the Tour de France podium if it's not Del Toro, if it's not Vingegaard, later in the episode, in part two.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
The script is already written. I've got it all figured out. We can all, Barone, you're going home tomorrow, but we can all go home and consider this a done deal. Why? Because if you cast your mind back to 2018, Simon Yates effectively lost the Giro d'Italia on the Colle delle Finestre. on the penultimate day of this race, we've got the Colle delle Finestre again. What a perfect redemption that would be. Not only that, but the way that Isaac Del Toro is riding in this Giro d'Italia is reminding me a lot of the way Simon Yates rode in 2018, i.e. he is in a state of total euphoria because he's never had such good form in all of his life, and he cannot help himself. He's chasing every move, he's going for every bonus sprint, and Simon Yates did much the same thing in 2018. So, Pelacci, as they say in Italian, tutto torna. Everything comes back, the circle will be complete. That's what I want to say. Well, Lionel, that was my finest hour in 2025 in cycling podcast, maybe even possibly even in my life in general, and predicting the extraordinary remontada, which of course is a Spanish word, for Simon Yates in the 2025 Giro d'Italia. What we didn't know, what none of us had predicted, although we were privy to some sort of speculation, some rumours about this, was that Simon Yates would call time on his career at the start of 2026. Now, we haven't done a podcast since this news broke a week ago now, wasn't it, Lionel? But I suppose your reaction was similar to mine, Lionel, in the sense that I think you heard this rumour from the same source, same sometimes dubious source as me over the summer. But I actually went back and looked at the text message, and there it was. I think it was the 20th of July, Lionel, which was a few days after Simon Yates took his Tour de France stage win. And what we were told then was that Yates wanted to quit at the end of the Giro. He was reminded of his responsibilities by the Visma Lisa Bike management. The key responsibility being that he had to help Jonas Vingegaard at the Tour de France, but that he was pretty determined still to end his career at the end of 2025. Now, I already alluded to the fact that Visma Lisabike didn't seem to know, and they sort of reaffirmed this yesterday. Some of the management kind of reaffirmed this yesterday. Grisha Neerman said it wasn't on their bingo card. Maybe we can talk about that in a second. But Lionel, I imagine you had the same thoughts as I did when you
learned last week that
Yates was going to quit.
It came from a man in a pub during the Tour de France. I was casually strolling past the pub, and this little nugget of information, which was that the word in the peloton was that Simon Yates wanted to quit pretty much there and then, had wanted to bow out, as you say, after the Giro, you know, end on the ultimate high of winning the Giro d'Italia, but was such a key part of the Jonas Vingegaard Visma Lisabike backup at the Tour de France, that he was pretty much obliged to carry on. Of course, he won that stage, didn't he? And he rode with a kind of joie de vivre, a kind of carefree nature that perhaps, and certainly when he did the press conference, I remember thinking, this is a slightly different Simon Yates to, you know, he's not as tight and as tense as sometimes he can be in those situations. But when I heard this bit of gossip that, well, he wants to call it a day as soon as possible, perhaps even in Paris, and he's on the pizza plan, you know, ordering himself a pizza every day, I sort of dismissed it as just tittle-tattle, gossip, outlandish, the sort of thing that my aversion to speculation is based on. But then when the news came, it did strike me that perhaps he, you know, all sorts of things went through my mind. Was he waiting to the end of the year, you know, collect his final salary for December and then make the decision? Was he going to carry on training and see how he felt? We don't really know the full details here, but I think, you know, the sense is that you know, he maybe achieved what he wanted to achieve in cycling and the time felt right. I mean, you made the point, Daniel, and have made the point a lot over the years, that he's kind of unknowable, Simon Yates, in a lot of ways.
Well,
it's tricky to really get a handle on, you know, what drives him, what motivates him. Quite a dry character at times.
I was thinking about this the other day. It was the Golden Globes the other day, and there's a female comic that was presenting it, Nikki Glaser, and she made a joke at the expense of Leonardo DiCaprio and his tendency to date women much younger than him. And she said,
Daniel.
Well, she sort of apologized to him as she was making the joke, and she said, look, you've given sort of one in-depth interview in 20 years. We know absolutely nothing about you. And it made me think of Simon Yates. You know, interviewed him almost on a daily basis at Grand Tours for 10 years and never really was able to glean too much about what made him tick, really, or what else was sort of in his life besides cycling. Did he harbour a yearning to do other things with his life? I mean, one thing I can say is that, you know, speaking to former colleagues, teammates, team manager over the last few days, I mean, they're not particularly surprised. I spoke to one of his former teammates yesterday who said that he remembered, he had a clear memory of a conversation in 2019. They were at a race and everyone was sort of around the table. Matt White was there as well. And Simon Yates talking there very explicitly about wanting to end his career at age 32 or 33, which is what he's done. I think he's 33, isn't he? However, he did sign a two-year contract with Visma Lisa Bike. So he obviously envisaged continuing at least to the end of 2026. The other thing that this former teammate said was that Simon was a brilliant leader. And in fact, both of the Yates is fantastic leaders, polite, grateful, no kind of sort of diva-like behavior. They didn't have big entourages, which obviously some team leaders do in other major teams, but that if you put too much pressure on Simon Yates, and maybe this explains to a certain extent his relationship with the media as well, if you put him under any kind of pressure or what he saw as excessive pressure, then you tended to lose him. Were the words that this former teammate used. And I mean, there's been this has sort of been seized upon the last few days, Lionel, that Dylan van Baarle has given an interview. He, of course, has left Visma Lisa Bike and gone to Sudal Quickstep. And he's talked about training. I think in relation to Yates, he was asked about Yates and he made a comment about training methods, sort of suggesting, maybe speaking a little bit out of school, but sort of suggesting that the training methods weren't necessarily to Yates's liking. What we do know about Visma Lisa Bike is that, well, that team is reputed to be very well sort of organized, but also a little bit maybe prescriptive at times in a similar fashion to sort of DSM PostNL. They have that reputation as well. And again, we are really speculating here, but it could be that style didn't necessarily suit Yates. I think my impression was that at Green Edge, both of the Yates brothers, but particularly Simon, had quite a long leash, really. Certainly in terms of, you know, media obligations, that kind of thing. I think they knew and understood very early in his career that he was not someone who was going to react well to being put under too much of a certain type of pressure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about the Giro d'Italia that he won last May, and it was a perfect example of somebody winning a Grand Tour without even trying to win a Grand Tour, wasn't it? I know you were Nostradamus in calling it early, but he rode so far under the radar for so long, and I suppose he spent a lot of his career like that, and he really pushed against this kind of redemptive narrative arc that we all imposed on him. The way he lost the Giro d'Italia on the same mountain, even early in that kind of recovery from that, you know, he put what he'd learned in that Giro to good use to then win the Vuelta a España. And in a lot of ways, I think quite an underrated rider, Simon Yates, you know, perhaps hasn't had the plaudits that his results and his performances have deserved. And you say that about, you know, the media, you know, his perhaps a reluctance to talk about himself or be in the spotlight in the way that everyone kind of expects winning riders to be. Once this news had broken, Daniel, I went back through our archive of Friends of the Podcast episodes and bumped up an interview that I'd done with both Simon and Adam together in November 2015, so just over a decade ago, when they were both riding for Bike Exchange. They come to the end of their second seasons as professional riders, and Brian Nygaard, who was working with the Bike Exchange team at the time, had been instrumental in setting that up and had really impressed on me how reluctant they were to do an interview together. They really didn't want to be seen as if they sort of came as a pair. And so I was kind of braced for a tricky conversation. that episode is now right at the top of our Friends of the Podcast feed. And I think it's quite interesting to go back and listen to people talking, you know, 10 years ago about careers that were stretching out in front of them and what they'd learned in the first couple of years as riders. And now to listen to that with the context of knowing what they went on to achieve, well, people who are Friends of the Podcast subscribers can do that. But a very fine career. And, well, it leaves us with just one Yates in the peloton. Adam is carrying on. I wonder how many more years he will do.
Yeah, I mean, people who know them both say they're actually very different characters and probably motivated by quite different things. You know, I agree with you, Lionel, very underrated rider. A rider who I very much sort of respected for how true to himself he was. He was very authentic. That sort of taciturn nature, his kind of reticence in dealing with the media, you always felt that that was very authentic, particularly when he was on a bad day. Or, you know, I would go through this whole sort of protocol or rigmarole with his press officers over the years of a sort of request to speak to him on a given morning at a Grand Tour in particular, and very, very often the message would come back, Simon doesn't understand why you want to talk to him today because he's not going to do anything today. It's a flat stage. And you know, often this was sort of the day after something very significant had happened with Yates, or the day before something very significant might happen with him. And, you know, over the years, it sort of almost turned into a bit of a joke with him, a bit of a kind of private joke where he would sort of finally rock up reluctantly. And you would kind of make a joke of his reluctance, and his kind of frown or his sort of stern expression would crack into this, and he'd you know, give you this sort of booming laugh, and there'd be this kind of mutual recognition that he knew he made your life a little bit difficult, but that was kind of okay because you sort of, you know, you recognize that was just part of his persona. But anyway, Lionel, prediction number 14 for me was that Simon Yates won't be seen at any bike race, professional bike race in 2026. I can't imagine he's the kind of guy that we will see just sort of mincing about at the roadside.
Oh, you mean this is a post-retirement announcement prediction? Yes. That we won't see him even when races go into Andorra?
Or doing media work. I don't know, maybe in Andorra. I don't know what his future plans are. I don't know whether he intends to stay in Andorra. Some riders do. Dan Martin has stayed in Andorra. I should mention Dan Martin's extraordinary running performances recently. He broke 30 minutes and 10K the other week, which is probably in the catalogue of amazing performances by current and former cyclists, that might be the greatest ever up there. Well, up there with Jimmy Whelan, who got a lot of attention a few weeks ago in Valencia. Lionel, a few more predictions. Should we have a few more from some of our friends? Shall we go now to it's Dani Arribas, who of course was with us at the Vuelta a España last year, Michele Pellacci, who was with us at the Giro, and Killian Kelly, who, based on his prediction, might never be heard again on the Cycling Podcast.
Hey guys, it's Dani Arribas here from Madrid. Daniel, if you ask my dear mother. And yeah, my prediction for the upcoming season is probably a bit controversial, but yeah, we're here to play. So here we go. Primoz Roglic wouldn't have any single victory in 2026. 36 year old, 37 at the end of the season. Yeah, it is true, four-time Vuelta champion, and he will for sure try to win his fifth in Granada this year. But I don't know, I have a feeling that he won't do it. But yeah, I think 2026 will be the first year since 2014, I think, the year he achieved his first victory, in which Roglic won't add any single win or any single victory to the 91 that he already has.
Ciao Daniele, ciao a tutti. It's Michele Pellacci here from a rainy Parma, Italy. My prediction for the 2026 season is a bit of a long shot, probably not going to happen, but Filippo Fiorelli, the newest member of Team Visma Elisabike, one pro win in his palmarès. He's going to win more races as a road cyclist, more races in 2026 than Wout van Aert, his future teammate. in that Visma Lisa bike team.
Hello, this is Killian Kelly from rival podcast Did Not Finish. Daniel has clearly gone for an if-you-can't-beat-them-join-them approach in his attempts to quash the growing popularity of such an obvious threat to the cycling podcast. In 2026, I think Remco Evenepoel will struggle adjusting to his new team. After a series of early season problems with management and equipment, he'll end up cracking mentally, having a tantrum and abandoning the Tour de France, which will leave us with the situation where, having purposely avoided each other all year, Evenepoel will then poop Roglic's party at the Vuelta, which will be deeply uncomfortable for the riders, but fascinating for the rest of us. And I think the Pog Vanderpoel stranglehold on monuments, it has to end sometime, so I predict that Mads Pedersen will win Paris-Roubaix.
Lionel, Daniel Rivas, very tough on Primoz Roglic there, suggesting that he's not going to win anything, not even a raffle in 2026. Pelacci,
What can we say?
What can you say about Pelacci and his prediction? Filippo Fiorelli is going to win more races than, well, Van Aert. If you go on Instagram today, no doubt Pelacci. Pelacci posts about his adoration of Wout van Aert practically on an hourly basis on Instagram. So he seems to be having an argument with himself and his own subconscious there. And Killian Kelly plugging other podcasts and being the sort of provocateur that he always is on social media in particular. I think most listeners are familiar with his work, with his output. Suggesting that Remco Evenepoel is going to have a tantrum in the Tour de France. He's going to go to the Vuelta and there'll be a big power struggle with Primoz Roglic. We know that those two currently are not due, their paths are not due to cross. I think, Lionel, and I think this is another one on my list of predictions, talking of power struggles at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, I think Lipovic and Evenepoel at the Tour, I've got that down as one of the most sort of succulent, titillating storylines of the Tour de France. Was that it? Yeah. Pedersen winning Paris-Roubaix. I mean, that's not going to shock anyone, is it?
Well, Pedersen's giant single chain ring setup seems perfect for Paris-Roubaix. I would have thought after he won the final edition of Gent-Wevelgem last year before its spectacular and much anticipated name change. Primoz Roglic, yeah, the predicting the sort of demise of a rider who has won races every year and, you know, sometimes fistfuls of races. Last season, he only won three times, all of them in Catalonia. There's a couple of stage wins and the overall there in March. He's on 91 wins for his career. The 100 Club is actually pretty elite. I think there's only around 25 riders who have won 100 or more races in their career. It's a really difficult one to quantify this because obviously Eddy Merckx is the big figure with Eddy Merckx is he won 525 races, but around about 300 of those are what we would these days consider, you know, bona fide wins. A lot of the others were criteriums, commesses, that sort of thing. And of course, races have been categorised differently over the years. I'm digressing slightly here, but I think Roglic will win a race. I mean, that could well be one of my
predictions. I don't think he's going to get to 100, is he?
He's not going to get to 100, certainly not this year at the current sort of rate of decline.
Roglic's going to be really interesting because it wasn't a good year last year. And of course, at the Tour de France, he sort of showed up with this. Well, I think we probably read too much into some of the things he said and his whole kind of sort of demeanor in interviews where, and there was his comment about not really caring that was maybe taken out of context and extrapolated. But, you know, talking about, you mentioned earlier, a sort of D-mob happiness, Simon Yates' kind of D-mob happiness at the Tour last year. And Roglic displayed a little bit of that last year, and I don't know, there are a lot of sort of intermingling factors here. Has his decline been accelerated by the change of teams a couple of years ago, and by moving to Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, did he sort of accelerate his kind of him toppling off the sort of age curve? I don't know really. He's still obviously a fast rider, and as long as he does enough races that finish on short, small, steep climbs, then he's going to have a lot of opportunities. That's one thing you would say about Roglic.
Yeah, I think it's one of these kind of transitional years, or one of these years where does he and his team, do they imagine him to be the Primoz Roglic of old, or are they pragmatic and do they tailor him to perhaps more modest objectives? Because there are still races he could win, but they're not races that he'll win if he still has his eyes set on much bigger prizes. And I'm sure he would want to win the Vuelta for a fifth time, but you know, maybe that will be beyond him by the time we get to that point in the year, because as we all know, you know, the months start to weigh a bit more heavily on people when they get older. You know, I am. You know, that's another 8 months away from here, and you know, anything could kind of happen. Regarding Evenepoel, I mean, Kilian is reverse predicting here, because that is very much the fate that befell him at last year's Tour de France. It does strike me that there is an awful lot of pressure on Remco Evenepoel's shoulders when it comes to the Tour de France, because it isn't just the fact that he's been leveraged out of his Soudal Quick-Step contract and quite a sum of money has been spent to get him across to Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, but he's got that whole weight of Belgium on his shoulders as well. And I can see where Kilian is coming from there. You know, if anything does go wrong at the Tour de France or in the preparation for the Tour de France, he does have a fallback, a way to redeem himself and his season at the Vuelta.
Yeah, I think that's going to be fascinating, Remco and Lipovic at the Tour de France, just because you've got the two sort of very powerful competing forces there of Remco's personality. And we've spoken before about the sort of behind the scenes documentaries that have shown us a bit, and what we've observed as well at races of Remco's charisma in a team environment and what a good communicator he is, and how basically a lot of the time he seems to be calling all of the shots at Soudal Quick-Step. And I think automatically he will sort of slip into that groove again at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. As I say, I think that's just his personality, versus Lipovic, who's a much more shy and retiring character, but who at the Tour de France, and we already saw this last year, is going to be pushed and propelled and sort of puffed up by a very sort of insistent German media and a very excited German media. They can be very obsessive about German rider when they do have a big German rider, and there's going to be a lot of pressure coming from them. It's a German team as well. So I think that's going to be a really fascinating dynamic. And Lipovic, for all that he is an unassuming character, he's a very robust, he strikes me as a very robust rider. He's not a rider that has had big sort of ups and downs over the last couple of years. When he has been fit, he's generally performed. So I think they are going to have some hard decisions to make in that team at the Tour de France.
Lipovic also has the difficult second album syndrome to cope with, that expectation, also the self-imposed thought, you know, does he want to submit himself to riding for Evenepoel in a team capacity, or does he want to get as far through the Tour de France in as high a position overall as possible and maybe aim for the podium again in his own right? There's a lot of moving parts there, because Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, on the face of it, when you're lining up the head-to-head between them and UAE Team Emirates, they're probably one of the only teams that's going to have a 1-2 that might challenge UAE Team Emirates and, you know, have that sort of depth and those alternate cards to play. Not that I'm for 1 minute suggesting that, you know, Pogacar is going to need someone to be a foil or an alternative or a backup in quite the same way, but it's a really intimidating force that UAE Team Emirates have developed, and the pressure will be really on Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe to kind of present something that goes head to head with them.
Just a final thing on Pellacci's outlandish prediction about Fiorelli winning more than Wout van Aert. Fiorelli's going to be a really interesting signing for Visma Leasebike. Of course, he spent his whole career, I think, at Bardiani, and not a young rider. He's a sort of fast puncher. But he had been and has sort of been earmarked as a lead out man, or someone who can be very useful in a lead out, a bit like Owain Doull, who's gone there. But Fiorelli, this sort of narrative or this kind of nugget has gone around the Italian media line, or that Visma Leasebike, they latched on to him because some of their analysis had showed that he was one of the riders who crashed the least frequently, almost infrequently, in the peloton. I would be intrigued to know how they've ascertained that, but how suitable that makes him for lead outs and so on and so forth. He's been talking about Visma Lisa bike. The biggest of culture shock for him so far has been how much they eat there. He's struggling, he's been saying in the Italian media, to eat everything he's been told by the team's nutritionist to eat. Incidentally, we talked about nicknames earlier on, Ving the Merciless, how that's not going to catch on in 2026. Fiorelli has one of the best nicknames, and there are still some lesser known Italian riders with great nicknames. The Freccia Rossa di Ficarazzi, the Red Arrow. He's got red hair, of course. But the Freccia Rossa is also a fast, high-speed Italian train. Ficarazzi is the suburb of Palermo in Sicily, where he's from.
Is Fiorelli not small flowers? Is it not also a type of pasta, shape of pasta?
Yeah, it can be.
I mean, if he's going to win more races than Wout van Aert this season, well, he hasn't got a lot to back that up in his locker so far. 31 years old, two major race wins, the Tour of Albania overall in 2019 and a stage of the Sibiu Cycling Tour in Romania in 2022. So quite a bold prediction from Pellacci there. I just wanted to go back to Killian Kelly briefly, because we'll probably talk about Ineos Grenadiers a bit more in the next part. But last year, Killian predicted that Ineos Grenadiers would collapse, fold, disappear mid-season. Now, that didn't happen. And they were one of the big movers in the transfer market, signing up Oscar Onley from Picnic Post NL. And we'll probably dive into that in the next part.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also supported by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network there is. And let's face it, internet security is not something we should take lightly. I've been a NordVPN customer for years now, and the benefits are numerous, not least keeping your private data like bank details, passwords, and your online identity safe and secure. But you can also save money on buying things like flights, hotel rooms, and subscriptions by simply switching your location and finding cheaper prices. But it's the internet security that really drew me in. NordVPN's threat protection means that you're protected from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing sites wherever you're connected and whatever device you're using, because you can use one NordVPN account on up to 10 devices. So you're covered whether you're at home or on the move. The best way to get a really good discount off your NordVPN plan is to use our link, which is nordvpn.com/TCP. That will give you 4 months extra free when you take out a 2-year plan. There's no risk either with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link will be in the episode show notes. So that's nordvpn.com/TCP.
Well, Lionel, should we have our last round? There might be a stop press, because there are a few individuals who owed me predictions but have yet to deliver. Larry Warbass.
Oh, they're outside the time limit.
Larry
outside
Warbass.
The time
Jack
limit,
Hake.
I'm afraid.
Anyway,
Commissaire, not going to allow any.
Yeah, we might have them.
Leeway.
We might have them next week. But anyway, let's have for the last three that have come in, shall we?
Hey guys, Magnus Orre from TV2 Norway here. I think 2026 will be the year of the flops. I think quite a few of the big name, big money signings this transfer window will backfire. Not that Kian Uytvedt, Oscar Onley, etc. aren't good riders, but their transfer fees seem, if correct, to be quite big. And in an era of Pogacar, Evenepoel, Van der Poel, I just don't think they'll be able to provide sort of return on investment for their teams. I also think Ineos, Soudal Quickstep will struggle yet again after some questionable recruitment this off-season. On a more positive note, prediction number two, I think Juan Ayuso will have a brilliant year. I think he'll silence his critics. I think he'll be an exemplary teammate for a while anyway. And I think he'll podium at the Tour de France, just behind Tadej Pogacar, but slightly ahead of Vingegaard and Evenepoel.
Juho Kurvits My prediction for this season is very simple. Without crashes and injuries, we'll have exactly the same thing in the spring as in 2025, a battle between Mathieu van der Poel and Tadej Pogačar. Even though the Flying Dutchman could become the absolute record holder of the Ronde van Vlaanderen, I'm betting on Tadej Pogačar becoming co-record holder with a third victory. The double world champion will also dominate the Tour de France and become co-record holder there. Especially now that Vingegaard is riding the Giro d'Italia first. I think Paul Magnier could be the breakthrough rider of the spring. The Frenchman of Soudal Quickstep was already second in the Omloop at Nieuwsblad 12 months ago, and after a fantastic autumn, he should be capable of winning a World Tour race like at Nieuwsblad, Dwars door Vlaanderen or Gent-Wevelgem.
Dear Daniel, dear Lionel, Happy New Year to you and all the listeners of the Cycling Podcast. This is Brian Nygaard sending you a message from Liguria here in Italy. So my prediction for the 2026 season, and I hate to be negative, and I don't really think it's particularly negative, but it's at least realistic. So my prediction is, coming from what I saw yesterday at the Visma Lisa Bike team presentation regarding the program of Jonas Vingegaard, seeing that he's doing the Giro Tour double, my prediction is that once he's done with the Tour, I don't think we're going to see him racing anymore in this season. I think his program will be what we've seen yesterday. So that's the UAE Tour, Catalunya, Giro and Tour. And I think that'll be his program entirely this season.
Lionel, Magnus has quite a good record at these. Although last year, I'm just looking back, what did he predict last year? Oh, he predicted a UAE clean sweep of the Grand Tours, and that they would win four of the five monuments. He was wrong about that, but they did have a very good season. I think he's got a bit of a thing for Juan Ayuso. He predicted that Juan Ayuso was going to win the Giro last year. That didn't happen either. He predicted Valmeda was going to win the Vuelta. He predicted that Jonas Abrahamsson would be the breakout star and would win two stages of the Tour de France. Of course, he only won one. Anyway, this year, that was 2025. This year, Magnus thinks there'll be a lot of flops. There'll be some flops. It'll be a floppy year. Kian Uterbrooks moving to Movistar. Oscar Onley, of course, that's one of the big deals, certainly, of the winter. Magnus doesn't think they'll do very well, controversially. He predicts that Ineos and Soudal Quickstep, based on their recruitment, will struggle. But Juan Ayuso will have a remontada, a revival, and finish second at the Tour de France. Hugo Corvitz, our friend in Belgium, he says that Pog will win Tour of Flanders and that Magnier will be a breakthrough talent. Can Magnier be considered a breakthrough talent after all that he won last year? And Brian Nygaard suggests that Jonas Vingegaard, much like Simon Yates, won't be seen at all in 2026. Jonas Vingegaard won't be seen anywhere by anyone, except maybe his wife and children, after the Tour de France. Any thoughts on any of those, Lionel?
Well, the Ineos question and Oscar Onley. I mean, that was the big Christmas news, wasn't it? It was like opening the advent calendar on, I think it was the 23rd of December. The news broke that Oscar Onley had moved to Ineos Grenadiers from Team Picnic Post NL after his incredible Tour de France in the summer, where he finished fourth overall and really was on the coattails of Tadej Pogačar and Jonas Vingegaard at some really key times in the race. You know, especially early on, I remember the stage to Rouen. He was just alert, racing, lively, not really the sort of facsimile of a rider that sort of fits the Ineos Grenadiers mold. He certainly wasn't racing in that way. He was, you know, dynamic, I thought. In tandem with that, Ineos Grenadiers were having a bit of a lukewarm Tour de France until Tymon Arensman saved it with those two stage wins in the final week. Graham Wilgos and I were talking in the Tour de France podcast about, you know, what had kind of gone wrong with Ineos Grenadiers since Jim Ratcliffe's takeover in 2019. And one of the things we identified was that it didn't seem to have its fingers on the pulse when it came to identifying and securing good young British talent. So many riders had sort of missed, they'd missed out on, you know, notably Matt Brennan, Oscar Onley being one, but there are others too, aren't there? You know, Jake Stewart, Max Poole, Ben Tulett, Joe Blackmore, Tom Glogue, Callum Thornley and Finlay Pickering in more recent years have all gone elsewhere. And a lot of those riders have gone elsewhere, primarily, I suspect, because other World Tour teams have got a development plan starting with a development team, something that Ineos Grenadiers haven't had until this 2026 season. They're debuting their development team. I think five of the 12 riders on that initial roster for the development team are British. There's a lot of pressure on Oscar Onley to repeat his performance. You know, he will kind of go into the Tour de France as the number one leader, I guess, based on last year's result. There are some parallels with Bradley Wiggins. I mean, lots of people have talked about this trend of riders being bought out of their contracts. Juan Ayuso to Little Trek being one. Speculation about how much it's cost Ineos Grenadiers to buy Onley out of the contract. Velo News, our colleague there, Andy Hood, was citing some information that he has that it cost Ineos more to sign Oscar Onley than Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe had paid to get Remco Evenepoel out of his contract.
That can't possibly include the wage. I mean, the buyout fee, yeah.
Yeah, the buyout fee. He does make that distinction. Onley's wages are lower than Evenepoel's, according to this article on Velo, but the actual buyout fee. But that would be related to the length of contract and the compensation that the team would require. So Team Picnic Post NL have probably driven quite a hard bargain. I remember in December 2009, Bradley Wiggins was, you know, levered out of his contract with the Garmin team to join the brand new Team Sky, having just finished fourth in the Tour de France. And that was quite rancorous, really. It got a little bit, it got played out in the media a bit. That transfer happened on December the 10th, and at that time it felt like literally the doors were closing. This got completed, or certainly got announced, a lot later, you know, right in the sort of nick of time at the end of December. But it is interesting that Ineos Grenadiers have probably paid a premium there to get a talented young British rider who's made a big breakthrough onto their roster. Probably does it balance out? Has that been a cheaper option than to buy a kind of a rider who, or not necessarily at the, he's not necessarily the finished article, far from it, but they haven't had to spend anything on sort of developing talent and, you know, hedging bets on which riders might or might not make it. Because, of course, you know, not all of those 12 riders on that first development team roster for Ineos Grenadiers are going to necessarily graduate to the World Tour team and have a successful career. So it's an interesting transfer at this sort of transition in model that Ineos Grenadiers have got. You know, they've been a bit like the football team that signs riders who are a bit more experienced and have proven themselves at the highest level, and now they're going into the realm of trying to match teams that are currently a long way ahead of them in terms of developing young riders. But the question is whether Onley can step up and be that leader, because he too has the kind of difficult second album syndrome to contend with the added complication of being the leader of a new and high profile team for him.
Yeah, a few things down that. I mean, why have they missed out on the best British talent? I think what you hear anecdotally about Ineos, what you have heard over the years, is that they have made decisions too slowly. There's been too much hemming and hawing, or too the decisional what's the word used in business line, or the basically that you have to go up too many tiers in the organizer, in the hierarchy. There are too many layers to the sort of decision-making process. And I think increasingly decisions are being made early and relatively quickly. There was an interesting interview Daniel Benson did with the new Sudar Quickstep, newish Sudar Quickstep manager Jürgen Fuhrer the other day, in which Fuhrer talked about their decision-making process as regards young riders, and he talked about how they are looking at riders for 2027 now and having meetings with riders for 2027 now. So that just sort of underlines that you have to move quickly in the market. The other thing is that what certainly fans can't appreciate, and we don't always appreciate or are privy to either, is that there are certain agents and certain relationships with agents that heavily, heavily influence certain teams' recruitment. And for many years at Ineos Grenadiers, it hasn't necessarily been the agents that have had a lot of British riders, the best British riders on their books, that have had the closest relationships with Ineos. So I think that's one reason, or those are two reasons why they haven't had maybe the best British riders. Maybe some of those good British riders have also looked at Ineos and looked at their record over the last 5 or 6 years of developing young talent and thought that it wasn't the best place to go as well. That might apply in a couple of cases. Just thinking about Oscar Onley, I was thinking sort of what's the bull case, what's the bear case for him at Ineos. I mean, you could sort of extrapolate the whole thing out and talk about this in great detail. I've already said that I think what it kind of inures him or ensures him and Ineos against a disaster or a situation where they are being accused of sort of fallen victim to second season syndrome, and it's a complete wipeout. I think that this is a rider who can excel in one day races and in on sort of punchy finishes, and it's not that the Tour de France success in the Tour de France is going to be the only metric by which he can be measured or which he can succeed. I think he can be pretty productive over the course of the calendar. What's the sort of case against Oscar Onley, and particularly him as a Grand Tour leader? I do think if you go back through history in Grand Tours, you do see these sort of puncher type riders who in a given Grand Tour will start very well and have a really good sort of first 10 days or 2 weeks, and then they end up being able to hang on and maybe digging deeper into their resources than they have previously ever done, and they will be able to do in future. I think of Julien Alaphilippe, the 2019 Tour de France, is a good example, but there are lots of other examples as well. And it could be that last year's Tour de France has given us a bit of a mistaken impression about what Oscar Onley actually is and what he's going to be in his career. He may be that he's a world class, he becomes one of the best riders in the world, but not necessarily as a Tour de France rider. I think that is a possibility. I don't know either way.
No, not at the moment, but my sense is that, you know, he's got a racing nose rather than just a kind of a GC group following machine. Yeah, and I think he's quick out of the blocks with Pogacar and Vingegaard when they were moving early in the race, and he's, like I say, a bit more dynamic than perhaps you would associate with certainly the sort of Team Sky method of all on the front riding in quite a sort of one-dimensional way. Just on the sort of differences between the sort of Team Sky development and Ineos Grenadiers development, obviously there was the break with British Cycling, which meant that as a default, Team Sky had their, you know, eyes on every young British rider, track, road, and beyond. So that kind of connection got fractured a little bit. Dave Brailsford is obviously back in at Ineos Grenadiers, and I think that has enabled the kind of the ladder of command to close up a bit. You know, we all know that in the heyday of Team Sky, Dave Brailsford's decision was first and final, and he was able to make decisions very quickly, and they moved quickly on riders, and they started to set the template for how this sort of recruitment is done now. My sense was, again, anecdotally, but from talking to people around the team a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, you know, Jim Ratcliffe basically had to give the say-so on, you know, what you might class as quite small decisions, decisions that perhaps the team could have taken without needing to refer it quite that far upstairs. And I gather that, you know, with Dave Brailsford back in, you know, he's got much more autonomy to make decisions early. So that's one thing. Then on Oscar Onley and following up on that fourth place, I mean, if you look back at riders who finished fourth in the Tour over recent years, it's one of those that could go either way, isn't it? João Almeida, Simon Yates, David Godu, Ben O'Connor, Mikko Landa a couple of times, Emmanuel Buchmann, Primoz Roglic, Adam Yates. You know, before that, it starts to get a bit murky because riders were stripped of podium positions and what have you. But it never necessarily follows that a good result is followed by a great one. That's the beauty of Grand Tour racing, isn't it? And there's often a bit of, you know, ups and downs. The key is that Ineos Grenadiers have got this opportunity to reset with Geraint Thomas going in as, you know, with all of his experience on the bike, learning a sort of managerial role. And it, like you say, Daniel, it will be interesting to see the direction that they push Onley in. Not yet confirmed exactly what he'll do. So maybe they'll surprise us and they'll target something completely different. And
they'll his main target of the year will be the City Manor copy of Bartoli, maybe.
Wow. Well, you know? Yeah, why not? Why not?
Yeah. Lionel, those are the sort of big ticket items, I suppose, that our correspondents, shall we call them, have thrown up. Any others you'd like to throw into the mix? As I said, we've already heard some of my 26. Can I pick a few others at random? The Sexas, the Paul Sexas hype train will be so big and unwieldy and scary at times that it's going to make us all wince. Like, I was thinking about the timing of the Tour de France next year. Well, the timing of the Tour de France every year. It's fairly predictable that it will happen in July. That's one thing we do usually get right.
Unless there's another pandemic. Yeah. Let's not tempt fate.
I was thinking about in terms of the resonance of cycling and cyclists and their achievements in any given country, and what is happening in other sports is always has an influence on that. And just thinking about the Football World Cup next year, and I personally don't expect the French team to do as well as they have done in maybe the last few World Cups. In the Football World Cup, and how that might concentrate even more attention on Sexas. We don't even know if he's going to do the Tour de France yet. But part of me thinks it's going to be brilliant for the sport, even when we do finally get a French star and a French winner of the Tour de France. We don't know whether that's going to be Sexas or not. But then part of me is also worried for whomever that person might be. I said a few weeks ago on the podcast that the bigger problem will come for him if he wins the Tour de France, or when he wins the Tour de France, however many years away that is. But I think that we will all be surprised to a certain extent and taken aback by just how big this thing will get if he is in contention for the Tour.
I thought you were going to say there that Paul Sexas would be on the long list for Didier Deschamps' World Cup squad.
Well,
and that
he'd
be... What position would he play? He's quite a slight fellow, isn't he? You put him on the wing.
Yeah, he's tall, though.
He's tall.
He could do a job up front.
Maybe.
Yeah, Sexas, the Sexas hype train, another hype train. Giulio Pellizzari, I think, will be Vingegaard's biggest rival at the Giro d'Italia, which, again, will be something to behold. The Italians are absolutely gagging, absolutely starving for a bit of home success at the Giro. And I think based on his performances the last couple of years in major tours, he's got what it takes. Something more whimsical, Lionel, trends. There'll be trends in nutrition that we'll hear about. Obviously, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of talk about carbohydrates. Cherry juice. We've seen a lot of cherry juice at the end of stages. That's become almost ubiquitous. Next year, I asked an acquaintance of ours, nutritionist at Uno X Mobility, James, I don't know whether you pronounce his name, Moran. If it's like the former Manchester United footballer, Kevin Moran, it's Moran. It must be Moran, mustn't it? Moran. Anyway, James says that there'll be ongoing hype around broccoli shots. Another product to look out for, New Zealand blackcurrant extract that UnoX are already using. I've also been doing some research on something called Polynesian, well, it's a noni fruit, Polynesian noni fruit, which has similar, I don't know, performance enhancement claims, slightly dubious, but who knows? One of those might be the hot product of 2026.
So does this mean that we need to call Filippo Fiorelli, Filippo Friorelli? The broccoli of Palermo.
Excellent.
I was going to say this time last year, I remember we got a little bit of flack for pouring some ice cold water on the excitement around the One Cycling plan. Do you remember? This time last year, One Cycling was going to revolutionize cycling. Everything was going to be even better than it's ever been before. One Cycling, not because of us, I hasten to add, it's gone stone cold, hasn't it, as far as we can tell. It certainly, if anything is developing, it's developing very much in the shadows. There might be some uncertainty with regard to broadcast rights in the UK and further afield over the next year or so, especially with the sort of Paramount Netflix tug of war with the Warner Brothers TNT Sport. I mean, with no idea how that will play out and how the sports portfolio and specifically the cycling rights will be affected by that. It won't happen overnight or perhaps even this year, but certainly that's something that should be on people's radar. But it does seem like there's another attempt to revamp professional cycling and develop some kind of overarching narrative, this time being driven by a couple of team owners, apparently. Their names escape me at the moment. One is Bacala of Cedar.
One is Ivan Glazenberg of Q36.5.
That's it. Some details of this have sort of leaked out here and there. I mean, this is the ongoing discussion, the existential crisis about professional cycling and how it fits into the sort of global sports and entertainment landscape whilst retaining the things that have made it popular. The sense that there's always a more exciting looking bus coming down the street for professional cycling. I'm not necessarily sure that's the case. I think that, Daniel, we were reflecting on this a couple of days ago in an unrecorded podcast, talking about how, you know, wages are higher than ever. Team budgets are very high. Actually, and this is perhaps, may not stand up to scrutiny because I haven't done the sort of analysis on this, but there's certainly a sense that sponsorship and team ownership is more stable than it has been. Certainly in the past, there's been sort of crisis after crisis over the winter. And I do wonder whether any sort of new attempt to revamp professional cycling will focus, what will it focus on? Will it focus on streamlining and strengthening the core assets? Yeah. Will it place the team owners more closely at the center of the revenue generating, which seems to be what the team owners want? But you know, the great difficulty is how do they prize away the strength and power that the race organizers have, and do they accept and kind of recognize that there's a really powerful private public partnership at the core of what professional cycling is, certainly in Western Europe and Australia and elsewhere, where there's a great deal of government, taxpayer, public goodwill that just enables the sport to take over the roads in the first place, and that monetizing that isn't necessarily straightforward. And if you pour a load more money into the top of cycling, whether it comes from the Saudis or from broadcasters or sponsors or whoever, it tends to get spent on rider salaries and agents. And teams will always seemingly spend more on those things than they will on equipment and, you know, wind tunnel testing and what have you. So it's a really fascinating subject, this, and it's interesting that as One Cycling initiative seems to have gone cold, you know, there's another attempt to reinvigorate and sort of re-inspire professional cycling. And it always seems to be in the image of some other sport, as if the Tour de France ought to be the Super Bowl, the Champions League final, and, you know, the tennis Grand Slams all rolled into one.
Yeah, I think there'll be more talk about possibly the looming and scary prospect of a pro cycling or world tour sort of bubble bursting in 2026, whether that happens or not. Lionel, I was reflecting with you the other day on just the size of the organisations now. One really positive development is a company like Lidl Trek. Lidl actually buying the team, taking control of the team. They obviously have huge resources, but I was talking to you about the number of people on their staff. They obviously have a men's team, women's team, and a development team. But I made it 199 people on the staff, or certainly listed on the website, 9 doctors, 5 nutritionists, 3 psychologists, 6 chefs. I mean, not even you have 6 chefs line up. at home, videographers, social media people, so on and so forth. It's just a sort of dizzying number of people when you think about where cycling came from 15, 20 years ago. Teams that would have sort of one doctor. Team doctors themselves in the 80s, 90s were a new development in professional cycling. Press officers were a pretty new development in the early 2000s. Yeah. And then nutritionists, even coaches, were not something that teams employed until pretty recently. And now you have, 5, 10 in each World Tour organization, which is, it's pretty remarkable.
Well, I joke glibly that I think I preferred it in the old days, 20-odd years ago, when a rider from Index Alexia Aluminio could win the Giro d'Italia with one sports director, one soigneur, and the team camper van that they'd owned since 1983 and called Francesca. I'm being slightly glib there. Paolo Savaldelli, that was, by the way. But we don't see that. We don't see the minnows, the team, they cannot compete. They don't have the riders, they don't have the backup, they don't have the staff. There's just no way that a rider on a really small team, and even on some of the smaller World Tour teams, can actually compete with the might of UAE, Team Emirates and the others that have really sort of scorched off into the distance. And it strikes me that when the whole sport was having this argument sort of 10 years ago, they didn't see that the consequence of some of the things that they were pushing for was actually going to lead to a sort of an even more unequal playing field rather than a sort of strengthening of the base of the pyramid. And so, like I say, you could really unpick the last 20 years of professional cycling and all of those different initiatives of, races that are going to come along and challenge the Tour de France, or, we can make it into something even more appealing to younger people and a TV audience and social media and this, that, and the other. Yeah. We could go on this subject at length and in depth, and maybe we will in some kind of spin-off series at some point. But it strikes me that even the world of media has evolved so rapidly that it's like trying to shoot at a moving target, isn't it? 5 years ago, they would have been talking about how do we make the sport relevant on Snapchat. Now it's TikTok. Yeah. What will it be next time? So that's all something to mull over as the year goes on. But just on Lidl Trek, Daniel, smart move to take over the team, because imagine the discounts on cherry juice and broccoli shops. Yeah. Extraordinary. I'm going to check out my local Lidl and see if any of that is in stock.
I'm not sure they have a Polynesian noni juice extract. Yeah, lots to say in the line about that. Obviously a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a big conversation about diversification of professional cycling, geographical diversification, ethnic diversification, rightly so, long overdue in professional cycling. But as more wealth has come, more wealth has been concentrated in the hands of the already established, the already wealthy, and it has made bridging that gap, that chasm, even more difficult. And that's a real challenge for the sport. Lionel, I think that's about it. I wanted to just pat myself on the back for another prediction that I kind of got right in 2025, but just talking about bubbles. I said that we would see the end of the fetishization of youth, which is good news for you and I, for you and me. but that kind of, I just looked at some statistics that kind of happened. Slightly fewer teenagers making their debut in the World Tour in 2026. There are only 5 in 2026. There were 11 last year. Only 17 riders under the age of 21 making their debut in the World Tour in 2026, as compared with 21 in 2025, 24 in 2024. And the height of the fetishization of youth post-POG was 2023, when 29 riders under the age of 21 turned professional. Not much talk about POG in this podcast line. Another one on my list was that the domination of Pogacar is going to be the dominant conversation again, and how boring it is. But also, there will be a moment in 2026 when we're all talking for probably about an hour about the end of Pog's reign. You know, when Filippo Fiorelli is down the road and has 18 minutes in the Tour de France, in stage one of the Tour de France.
Well, maybe Pog will do a Simon Yates on the rest day in the Tour de France. I don't, yeah. I mean, you know, suddenly call it a day. Shock everyone. I can't see that. That's not going to make one of my 26 predictions for 26. No. Just before we go, I would like to say a big thank you to all of our friends of the podcast who have continued to support us, propelling us into our 13th full season as a cycling podcast. We, of course, first broadcast in June 2013 on the eve of Chris Froome's first Tour de France win. He wasn't quite a teenager then, but he is now... Well, he's almost the wrong side of 40. I think he is the wrong side of 40 now. If not, it'd be very soon. That gives some idea of how long we've been at the mic, and the support of our friends of the podcast is crucial. We really appreciate it. We've got plans to kind of even up the program of Kilometer Zero episodes a bit this year, because we're very aware that although we released a lot of episodes, they were all kind of front-loaded in the first half of the year. We're going to try and even that out a little bit in 2026, and we hope that you enjoy coming with us and our guest voices who will be joining us here and there over the coming months to follow the road racing season for both men and women.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.